Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fuck sticks, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Thanks for being here. If you can't tell, I'm in another hotel room. I've driven down from upstate New York. I am now in New York City. Woke up very early this morning to put on my new clothes, to go do Good Morning America, to promote GLOW. Did a very short segment. It's very odd when you get up and go into that machine early in the day. It's the first time I've done GMA, but I've done the Today Show before. But I wore my new sports jacket, my new shirt, and the shoes that I bought with the suit I bought for the award show. Those of you who keep up should know these are the first times I'm wearing this. First time I haven't bought a goddamn sports jacket in forever. I figure I'm a grown-up, I should be able to have something to wear. So I got suited up, got in the car, got up there, was put into some holding cell. And then all of a sudden, you just see, here we go. I saw John Hamm and Ed Helms walking off this weird set of GMA where people are just seemingly haphazardly put around different stages. And I'm let out, and I sit down next to a blonde lady who was very fit and very focused. I'm not even sure I got her name. I'm not even sure I was introduced. I'd never met her before, but there I was sitting across from her and doing a 5-minute segment. It's just like, bing, bang, boom, here's a clip. What's up? They had me reflect on Anthony Bourdain for about 25 seconds. They asked me about my jacket and me buying clothes because they read about it on the update that I send people every week for about 25 seconds. Talked a little bit about GLOW, somehow got off track, talked about cocaine, which was a caused a little bit of a, when you're on ABC and you're doing a Disney outlet, they get very nervous about I couldn't even say WTF to promote the podcast. And then I talked about my character on GLOW doing coke, and apparently there was a moment or two of panic in the control room as to whether or not we would have to shut down the show. I guess that's the world we live in, but I made it my own. I didn't say I was doing it. I didn't promote it. I said it was in the past and it was a character thing. I guess I did all the right stuff to not have a we'll be right back card go up in the middle of Good Morning America. No technical problem. Color bars card had to be dropped. No commercials had to be run abruptly. It all went okay. So now I'm back in the room. I'm just tired, man. I'm just fucking tired. I feel like I'm always tired. Just like doing the jobs. But thankfully, got a full show today. Holly Hunter. I talked to Holly Hunter back in the new garage a few days ago. Just I think it was like 3 days ago I talked to Holly. She is in the Incredibles 2. She is the voice of Mrs. Incredible. But before Holly, I'm going to spend a little time with Amber Tamblyn. She has a new novel out, Any Man, comes out June 26th. You can pre-order it now wherever you get books. I was also, I did a section of her audio book, and it was great to see her. But before I get into that, I'd like to also say that I am in New York, and I don't know if I covered this before. It seems to be in the life of a Jewish person that there will be many days where you walk around smelling like onions and fish. And for some reason, lately, when I get to New York, I compulsively go to Russ and Daughters. And I didn't go to the cafe this time. I went to the actual store because for some reason I've been on this no-carb diet with very little sugar. So there, it seems like there's very few things I can eat. But I don't know if I'm if it's really working that well. I just inhaled an entire jar of cashews. Could that be antithetical to what I'm trying to do on a weight loss level? Perhaps. But for some reason, I immediately went over to Russ and Daughters and got two fillets of Majus herring and just a mound of pickled onions on top and put that. Yeah, they put that in a plastic container. And I got a few slices, four slices, about an inch of beautifully sliced smoked sturgeon, just to travel back to the old country of my genetics, just to take a little journey through my genes back to Poland and Russia. So that happened. And then, of course, there's a problem with having interactions with people for hours, just fish and onions. That's what's happening. I think I even got a little bit of it still now. All right. So Amber Tamblyn, it's been a little bit, but we've talked. She's been on the show before. We've talked for an hour plus about poetry and other things. She's married to my dear friend Dave Cross. They have a child. We talk about that a little bit. We talk about her new book, Any Man, a bit. We talk about cultural momentum around women's issues and stuff like that. It's a good conversation. I'm glad she stopped by. It's always nice to see Amber. This is me and Amber Tamblyn back in the new garage. And how's the baby?
She's pretty fucking cute.
Yeah.
She's just started to walk. She's making a lot of eye contact
uh-huh.
while holding objects and then dropping them
uh-huh.
As if to say,
yeah, what are you going to do about it?
Pick that up. Fucking pick that up. What are you going to do, Mom? Pick it up. And then you're like, I'm not going to tell her. I'll pick it up.
Okay. Yeah, you pick it up.
Yeah.
How's old Dave doing with a baby?
He's amazing.
He's
a quite an extraordinary dad.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. He's really, really... a good dad.
Dave Cross, dad.
Yeah,
Dave Cross, dad. Oh, you did it. You did it.
Yeah, and he's getting ready to go out on another tour. We're doing two tours together, actually.
I know, I saw that, yeah.
It's going to be wild.
Where's he been running the material?
He's been all over the place. He was in Chicago. He was at...
playing small places?
I think like medium, mm-hmm. small. Yeah, some, but mostly working a lot of the material out at the Knitting Factory
uh-huh.
and places in Brooklyn and uh-huh. New York.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
So the book, I read the book. I read my part of the book.
Yes.
And it was heavy because I wanted to do it for you. I'm glad I did it. I think I put a lot of work into it.
I can imagine. And when I said, after Barry had passed away, and I said
Barry Crimmins.
Yeah. And I said, I don't know what I'm going to do. Like, I framed this around him
uh-huh.
And then, like, of course, it struck me. And David's like, I actually think, as much as I love Barry, I think Mark is a better choice. Like, he can really do this guy, this guy is.
good. Well, I think that's good. Well, I'm glad
it is
a
compliment. Yeah,
I'm glad I got Dave's vote of confidence. No, I was very engaged with the material, and I thought it was very intense. But I get a sense of the book and the project of the audiobook. It because it's not poetry. I think people are used to reading poetry, but it is prose poetry to a degree.
100%. Yeah. And I find that more interesting with novels, certainly as a writer of fiction now.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not really interested in the traditional models of how fiction is written. And for me, there's really not anything that I can do that doesn't have some form of poetry in it.
Of course.
And so for me, it was about changing the structures. Like, a lot of the other characters are not written in the way that, you know, that yours is. Some are told through, you know, just purely through their searches on the internet or through tweets.
Right.
Or then there's some that are just like really long, sort of beautiful pieces of prose.
Right.
But they're all very separate and very unique.
So what was the impetus? Because this is not long since your last book.
I mean, you know, I feel like the Book of Poems, which I imagine was done over a period, long period of time.
Yeah, that was Dark Sparkler took 7 or 8 years to put together. But that was really like an exorcism, like an existential metamorphosis. And this book took about 3.5 years.
Really?
Yeah. And I as a writer, I sit and I think for really long periods of time. I don't write incrementally. I sit and I think, I incubate, and then all of a sudden I write everything in like 4 months.
Huh.
Very quickly. It's why I still have carpal tunnel in my left hand. I've had it for 2 years.
Wow.
It comes and goes. I get it in my right hand sometimes too. I have a lot of ailments with my arms from
writing the way you do, like intensely writing.
My acupuncturist would say I am too curled into myself, which I think is a pretty accurate representation.
Just an armadillo, kind of like armor, you know, stay away.
That's exactly right.
Right. Wow. Because I was under the impression that the book was a reaction to what's happening culturally. I mean, the timing of it, and I know you've been...
I could have never foreseen this in a million years.
Like you've been very engaged with Me Too stuff and with your own story of dealing with predators and weirdos and men.
Yeah.
So I thought that this was like in reaction to that, but this was kind of going on before.
Oh, yeah. I thought about this over... I mean, the Me Too movement is still in its little baby infancy.
Uh-huh.
And it's about as old as Marlo, my daughter.
Yeah.
And this was 3.5 years ago. But, you know, I will say that this is... I should say what the book is about. The book is about a female serial rapist who attacks a group of men over the course of 2 years in the United States. And the book has many conversations at once. It is both, a conversation aiming to, I think, resensitize culture, specifically rape culture. But it is also, its aim is to sort of show the stories of men who are also fall prey to sexual violence and harassment and even forms of intimidation, especially in the entertainment business. It's rampant, but it's not really talked about because women are at the forefront of it, and it's predominantly happening to women. And it's also because you never really meet this horrible, horrible woman, Maud, who does these things. You never meet her in the book, really. The writer in me was really able to let my imagination run away with how people described her and what the media thinks of her and how CNN turns her into, part animal, which is what is based on some of the men who have described her in what they remember and what they don't remember. So it's also commentary on how we sort of mythologize women. And to me, I was really fascinated by...
And murderers.
Yeah, all of it.
Yeah.
I was fascinated by the idea of making a female protagonist who didn't have consequences in the way that I feel that men often don't have the same consequences that we do.
Uh-huh.
They don't have to speak for them necessarily. And what would it be like to have someone who wasn't, it wasn't revenge based, it wasn't going after a John or a dad or an ex-boyfriend, but it was just purely psychopathic. It was purely for power and for the enjoyment of harming people.
Not unlike most male predatory rapist killers.
Which is not about the act of the of the sexual harm. It's about the act of the power.
Right. So when you say resensitize, what does that mean?
I think conversations surrounding sexual violence, I think that they are, frankly, I think people are bored of talking about it. They're bored of reading about it. People get upset for a momentary amount of time, and then before you know it, it's back to business as usual, and things don't really change.
Yeah.
And for me, I wanted to degender the conversation, for lack of a better word. Mm-hmm. I wanted to really take that away and say, listen, this is a problem for everyone. This is a problem that affects all races, all genders, all peoples. It is systemic. It is endemic to our culture. And if we're going to start having real facilitated conversations about how to drastically, revolutionarily change things, then we have to push buttons and we have to start creating art that changes the way we think about things. It's not enough just to tell the story. We have to open the mind of the country and of the world, frankly. We have to change.
It's not, it's endemic in the culture, but it's also endemic in, you know, Western civilization.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So like if you're going to track patriarchy, right, it's not just cultural. It's the way shit is.
Yeah. And it's also, you know, the other conversations happening in the book that I think is most prominent, and your character who you voice in it is really sort of one of the people that starts rallying against it, is, you know, the book is an indictment of journalism. It's an indictment of our culture of social media and the way in which we perform care, the care of survivors, the care of women's stories, for short amounts of time, and then it's on to the next one. It's sort of this in this 24-hour cycle, and we honestly do more harm than we do good.
Well, I mean, I don't know
myself included, by the way.
Sure.
I'm on Twitter, like I feel the same way when I am going, is this helping? Am I helping?
Yeah, I kind of pulled out of the Twitter. Like I you know, I do it promotionally.
Yeah, David just did that too.
And like I'll occasionally answer questions, but I don't engage with garbage, and I just don't do it. I never did Facebook, but.
So wait a minute, you practice self-care?
A little. Yeah, believe me, I'm doing damage in other areas. So,
fair enough.
Yeah, I mix it up.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
All right.
No, but it's self-care in the sense, but I can't get off my phone in terms of news.
Yeah.
And in the same way, we do kind of nullify and numb ourselves to, you know, it's just like, boom, you're literally just punching yourself in the face with information.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to, you know, I've got a hard time dealing with, not so much empathy, but like, you know, the weight of others' pain in personal life.
Yeah.
So like to deal with it, like, you know, every day with news, and then to be, you know, have your ideological sensibilities and your sense of justice and everything else, you know, kind of, you know, attacked every day.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how we stand up to that shit. But I think that taking the time to write a novel where, you know, you have to think about it in a completely different way, you know, especially something that is as memorable as what this book represents. I mean, you know, it could reconfigure some synapses.
Yeah, and I think it'll probably upset some people, too. You know, there's already been a couple things here and there of especially women saying, like, you know, you're not helping anything by taking our pain and suddenly, like, trying to give it to men. And by flipping it, you're taking away from us. And I just fundamentally do not believe that. And I think if we're going to be talking about what this idea of equality means, and really getting past the point of telling stories, which is what the Me Too movement did so profoundly and beautifully, and moving towards actionable change. Like, what are we really going to do to change things so this doesn't happen? So when my daughter grows up, you know, I don't have to hear about her going into a meeting where some guy's going to pull his dick out in front of her.
Well, I think scaring the shit out of men is working a little bit.
It is. And it's also, I understand it's like, it's drastic and it's scary. And, you know, I have said, and I feel like men only like war when it's their kind of revolution.
Uh-huh.
And when it belongs to others, then maybe it's a little like, whoa, 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 we should slow down here and maybe have a rational conversation. But every time I come up against this, and every time I talk to a man, mostly liberal men too,
Those fuckers,
about what they think the answer is, you know, and I say, okay, fine, it's a witch hunt where we've gone too far. We're in the backlash, blah, 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 blah. Put your fucking coin word in here.
Yeah.
You know, what's the answer?
Well, I think,
and they don't ever have an answer. They don't have one.
Well, I think the answer, like just from a personal reaction and thinking about my past and my behavior, and I think that the simplest thing in terms of what it's provoked me to do is just to be, you know, mindful of where what I'm doing is coming from.
That's a lot.
That's all of it.
You have no idea how unique that is. And I think a lot of men are really, they push back against that.
They resist it.
Yeah, they resist it.
Well, you know, it's just like, do I need to touch her shoulder? Is this flirting? Am I acting out? Am I being, you know, inappropriate?
Yeah.
Is this space not, you know, why am I saying that?
The whole excuse, too, about how now, like, no one's going to be able to flirt anymore. No one's going to know what to do in the bedroom. Like, all of those things are performances, and they're deeply disturbing to me, and because they're disguised as ways to stop the larger work that's being done.
Uh-huh.
Because they know that's not true. If you have an ounce of understanding, you can still go fucking have some chick put heels on and step on your balls. You can go do whatever kinky...
Do I have to do that?
Yes, you do.
Okay.
Kinky, weird, amazing shit you want to do, as long as there's one word involved, and that's consensual.
Right.
It's like, it's not that hard. And if it takes you having to maybe use a few words
from your mouth
to ask or to figure out a way to say that, like, then that's what it is.
Okay. Okay.
All good?
No, and also the I think the conversation about, you know, the... kind of the power struggle or the misuse, the abuse of power in work environments, no matter how small, is really the I think it seems to be the heart of the cancer.
Yeah, it is.
You know, like what people do at home and how that, you know, how things are misunderstood or not. You know, I mean, those are conversations that, you know, have to be between people, right? But like what really resonated with me and what really made me think a lot was that even if you're in a workspace for a month or for, you know, a couple months or a week, that there is a dynamic there where, you know, it's not about the other thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you're acting in a particularly inappropriate way in a workspace, what is that about?
Yeah.
You know, really ask yourself about that. And then you go deeper with that. And then it's sort of like, what is it all about? You know, how do I really see women?
Yeah. And then also, if you're not that person, right?
Yeah.
Why are you also not, if you're seeing it happen to a woman, speaking up?
Right.
That's the other problem, is that we've got a world in which men have more allegiance to men's careers and livelihood than they do to women's physical safety. And that's really a problem, you know? And so they feel like, well, it's not my thing. I don't want to get in the middle of it. Or she could be exaggerating. And they always go to the things first that would mean that she's a liar and that she's not telling the truth. And that's one of the biggest problems that we face.
Right.
I think the fact that we are even having this conversation, you know, you and I sitting here in your garage, like having this conversation is in and of itself the manifestation of that change. And as painful as the last 6 or 7 months have been for a lot of people and many people that I know, you know, I think that it's so important to realize that this is really where it begins, the questioning and the wondering.
We're talking.
Yeah. And you can't change things overnight, right? You can't, just like you said, you can't suddenly say everyone has to be different immediately, stop, go. This is a learning curve. And for men, this is generations upon generations since the beginning of time of behavior. And so it's incremental. And you just have to be diligent and persistent and not waver.
Yeah, right. And also it requires men like me, like, you know, slightly, you know, recovering assholes.
Recovering assholes. You know, I love that.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, look.
My husband's a little bit of a recovering asshole. He's still an asshole, but he's a recovering
different
asshole.
Different kind of asshole, me and Dave. But yeah, he was sort of a cranky, self-righteous asshole.
Yes, that is correct. Bing! Accurate.
Yeah, you don't want to argue with Dave, do you?
Yeah. You should try to be in our household in the last 6 months.
Oh my God, he's stubborn, man.
Yeah, he's really stubborn.
Has the kid softened him?
Oh, totally.
Oh, I'd love to see that.
Yeah, it's he sings to her and he says funny fucking things while he changes her diaper and makes her laugh and is really good at distracting her.
Oh.
And I just get frustrated and.
Oh, that's sweet to
hear.
He's just
an extraordinary dad.
Great.
How
has having the kid changed you, like, for the better?
I think having a kid has weaponized me in a lot of ways.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
In the sense of her future?
Her future, but also my past, you know, when I think about the shit that I tolerated before.
Mm.
When I think about what I am worth and having known that as long as I've known that, and that the ways in which I've let people stifle that, and they really weren't, you know, I wasn't letting them. I was letting myself be stifled. You know, you can't blame other people for what's going on with you. You can only sort of look at your own actions with that. And so for me, so much of it has been about just what I won't tolerate.
Yeah.
It's pretty straightforward, and it's really nice to be able to go, oh, I get it now. There's something for me in this experience that's so important that all this other bullshit, like you said, doesn't matter. And
right.
I refuse to bend. I refuse to waver on it.
I find that like so much of that, looking back on stuff and not wanting to you know, seeing who you were, understanding who you were, and realizing that you were vulnerable, insecure, not aware, mm-hmm. That you know maybe you left yourself unintentionally or unconsciously vulnerable to whatever. Those are hard lessons to learn, but you know. You know, it's better than on some level, like just reacting early on and becoming a monster because of monsters.
I completely agree.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like some of it's just the natural evolution of sensitive people.
Yeah, I completely agree. It still doesn't make it any easier. But
no,
I
of
think...
course not. Yeah. And also to be aware for your kid, to provide whatever, you know, missing self-esteem you had. For whatever fucking reason, I'm to speak for myself as well.
Well, child actress, that's mine.
sure, but like you know, why were you, right? But nonetheless, it's that there seems to be a way, I think, to give children self-esteem and sense of self, or at least provide the environment to do that. I'm not sure that I was, even though I was it was a finely funded environment, was not a great environment emotionally.
Right. Yeah. That adds its own weight for sure.
Yeah, you think everything's good. Look, I get what I need. I got clothes and we have a nice life and my parents, we have money and whatever. And I'm completely emotionally incapacitated.
Wow.
but that's what it happens, right?
Were your parents together when you were little or did they divorce?
No, they were there.
They were
just self-involved.
Are they still married?
No, no, no. They were just a little self-involved, you know.
Got it.
Yeah. So, you know, I had to kind of figure some stuff out on my own.
Yeah.
So what made you get public about James Woods?
That's like one of those ridiculous...
Well, I mean, that's a weird question. I mean,
no,
I'm
know
glad
what
you did, but like it was just seemed to be like, was it just sitting there?
Yeah. So Armie Hammer and I did a movie together. He's a friend of mine.
Yeah.
We did a movie together in Spain years and years ago.
He's been around that long?
Yeah. It was like some small, some small movie.
Yeah.
And somebody I know had retweeted this thing that he wrote. And it was just one of those things, sitting on the couch.
Yeah.
Clicked it. Saw him say something to James Woods, who I did not know. I knew very little about. I certainly didn't know that he was such a conservative talking piece and also just a overall prick.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't know any of that at all. And I saw him, you know, this argument that was going back and forth about him, you know, he didn't like Armie's movie because it's about Armie having, a relationship with a younger man. And then Armie called him out and said, what are you talking about? You date 17-year-olds. And I did not also know that that was like a James Woods thing, that
right.
That was a thing he was known for. And then a memory popped into my head and I was like, oh, wait a minute. I remember when he tried to pick me up at Mel's Diner when I was like 17. Yeah, I was 17. I remembered it because of many factors. And
uh-huh.
I even like, I called my dad to double check. And he's like, oh yeah, I remember when you came home and told me about that.
And you knew it was James Woods.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
100%.
Yes. Yeah.
You know.
He's memorable.
He's memorable.
You never
that
forget that fucking face.
No. You never forget a predator like
uh-huh.
that. And so I just tweeted it. I think that's so indicative of the time we live in too.
Yeah.
You know, you just tweet it, but you forget you're living in a world where people are watching.
Right.
And because I think, you know, because of the election of Donald Trump, because of so many factors, really people were like ready to pop off. They
yeah.
were ready. You could feel it boiling under the surface for women and a lot of men. You could feel this sense of like, this is not happening anymore, and there's a riot is about to go on. And so it just turned into this huge thing, and I would have never gone further had he not, like, gone out of his way to give an interview to, you know, Variety or one of those things and call me a outright liar.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, I will fucking throw a brick through your life, motherfucker.
Yeah? Did you?
Yes. I wrote a couple pieces, and it is the reason I have, I'm a contributing writer for the New York Times, was because I wrote a piece there, which was widely read, called I'm Done with Not Being Believed. And it really was this idea of, like, you know, this idea that you have to go out of your way to prove yourself on so many insane levels.
Yeah.
It's so unfair. And oftentimes, you know, women have to come with like a stack of papers of evidence for a small thing like that happening. And mm-hmm. that the first reaction is to always second guess the woman.
Well, that's all part of the paradigm of, you know, the bitch is crazy.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
That's absolutely right.
That's like, that's one of the it's on the, you know, top five checklist of patriarchy. Oh, that bitch is lying. She's crazy.
Yeah, that's yeah. That's really true. And you know, I think that was that, and that happened like 3 months before the Harvey Weinstein story came out. So it was really in the air.
Was that early? I didn't realize the timing of it.
Yeah, it was like 3 months before. It was the reason that. And the article was so read and distributed.
The one about not being believed.
Yeah, that Jodi Kantor from the New York Times, who at that time nobody knew was working on the Weinstein piece, asked to speak with me through a friend.
Oh, really?
I didn't have anything to give her, but
right.
Like I didn't have any Harvey Weinstein stories, but
right. But you were sort
but
of
I knew about it.
Proceeding,
I knew it was happening.
Right. Yeah. And it was starting to build.
Yeah.
And you were one of the first things to pop off.
Yeah, it was sort of incremental. There were many of us that were really doing it. And then, you know, I think I'm also a founding member of Time's Up. And one of the great things that we've been doing, you know, Time's Up was like a thing that was a bunch of really pissed off, angry women who got in a room together mm-hmm. and just were like, what are we going to do? We're not going to just be angry anymore. What are we going to actually functionally do?
Yeah, how can we help? How can we help?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that to me is the catharsis. That's that to me is what makes me not feel like a crazy person, is to go, okay, we started Time's Up so that nobody ever has to say Me Too again. So no one has to do it. That's the point.
And how's the momentum? How are you guys still engaging? And
yeah, I mean, it's huge now. And it's, you know, like all movements, it's like, it's had its criticisms. Mm-hmm. And it's like trying to fly a plane while you're building it. It's hard. It's fucking hard. And you get hundreds of people with big ideas who are geniuses in their own right. And you're trying to like create a plan to shift Western culture as we know it. It can't be done overnight. So,
no.
But I think the progress that we've made is absolutely extraordinary. One of the very first things we did with the launch of it was, at one point, the women of the Farm Workers Union had signed a petition or a letter to us saying that they stand with the women in the entertainment business. So we wrote a response letter.
Uh-huh.
I think there was over 200 of us basically saying, we see you and we hear you and we stand with you in this effort to change the Farm Workers Union and even in the restaurant business and all these other businesses. And we tied that with a legal defense fund, which has raised over $30 million so far, which goes towards basically helping both men and women who are victims of harassment and sexual assault in the workplace.
I went out with a woman years ago. I don't know if Dave knew her, but she once said to me, and I can never forget it because it seems to be encapsulate a lot of stuff. She's a sculptor, you know, mm-hmm. very tough woman, interesting character. But she used to bartend at a strip bar, but she wasn't a stripper. But she's a bartender. It was in I think it was in Boston, and she quit. And I said, "Why'd you quit?" And she goes, "I got tired of men looking at me like I was food."
I like her.
But good luck with this book. I'm very happy about it. I'm happy to see you.
Yeah.
I'm happy to have been part of it. Who are some of the other people in part of the audiobook? Because that seems like a whole other thing, the audiobook.
Yeah. It's Ben Foster.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I want to meet that guy.
Oh, he's... Okay, I cannot wait to text him and tell him you said that, because when I was at his house two nights ago, and I told him I was coming to do this, and he goes, "Oh God, I want to meet that guy. I shit you not." So he's a fan of yours, and sometime I'm going to connect you guys. You need to interview him.
Yeah, I do. And I talked to Oren.
Oren.
Yeah. And, you know, we had a long conversation, me and Oren, and he came up, and I'm like sort of half obsessed with Foster. And
you'll become more obsessed once you meet him.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he's a dark night of the soul.
Huh. How'd that happen?
In the best possible way.
Okay, I'll find that out. Well, I'm glad we're on the same page with that.
Yeah.
So he's one, yeah?
He's one, and John Roberts, who's Lindon Bob's Burgers.
I haven't heard
from
him in a while. I haven't seen him around.
He moved to Jersey. Hmm. He's in Jersey. And my dad, Russ Tamblyn, a wonderful actor out of New York named Glenn Davis.
No Slappy?
Slappy did a voice for it, and then I had John come over and do it instead. Because the character is gay, and
did Dave do his gay guy?
He was gay, and but then it was actually it was David who was like, I think this is a bad call, and I think you should get like one of your rad. He did not say rad. David Cross did not say rad.
He said one of your gay friends.
Yeah, he just said get the real deal.
You have it.
So go.
I think that's
it.
Right. Oh, good. All right. Well, when's it out?
The book is out June 26th. It's called Any Man.
And you're going to send me one so I can read it on a plane?
No.
Thank you. Again, Amber Tamblyn's new novel, Any Man, out June 26th. You can pre-order it now wherever you get books. Listen, folks, I was excited to meet Holly Hunter. Wouldn't you be? It was very, just to see her come over to the house, show up, say she liked my house. We talked a little bit about patio furniture, front porch furniture, and then we went into the garage and knocked out the conversation. So, as I mentioned before, Holly is the voice of Mrs. Incredible in The Incredibles 2, which opens everywhere tomorrow, June 15th. And this is her and I talking about a lot of stuff back in the new garage. Me and Holly Hunter now. Sound good?
Good. I'm just going to put this down so I can actually see you.
I think that's a good idea. I appreciate the impulse. A lot of people, they don't know how to do a mic. But well, God knows you know how to do a mic.
Well, animated. We're here talking about a movie where I was at a mic.
Yeah.
It was so interesting. This guy at Disney, the same room. You would probably be really interested in this room. It was the same room where they recorded Jungle Book. Louis Prima came in playing.
With his orchestra?
Singing. Yeah, and but the guy there, Doc, he's the sound engineer. He's outfitted the recording booth with all these kind of the microphone is on a an automated, he can automatically move the mic with remote control from his booth.
And
normally, the guys are doing it. It's like analog. I mean, they're coming and adjusting it.
Yeah.
But he can do it from the booth kind of soundlessly. Yeah. So as you're recording, he can move it.
Oh, really? It'll just, the mic will just start moving? I guess it's less, cool. It's not as rude either as someone coming in going, like, could you just... focus on them.
Yeah. Cut, hold on, Holly. No.
It just adjusts.
And they have like these bars that fly down that you can hang from.
If you're
doing like really, physical stuff.
Oh, so you can get
the feeling.
It helps,
right? Or there's a bar also that you can push up against.
So you can act.
You can like pull it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of, Disney is obviously animated wise, they're set up for.
Yeah,
they got the legacy.
Yeah, of course, it's the original place. So you're at the old lot in this old room,
man. And it's so beautiful. It's so humble. You would love. You would particularly.
Yeah,
I think love it.
And you can feel the history of everything.
Yeah, it's very humble, very kind of like very low key.
Yeah, but where is it? In Burbank?
Yeah. It's in Burbank, I don't know. I particularly love recording there.
Uh-huh. And how long did it take to do this movie?
About a year and a half, maybe a year and a half.
Wow. Really?
But yeah, I mean, for me, though, it was nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, the animators were like breaking their asses to do
this. Right, I guess that's what you're not.
I was like coming in once a month and hanging out with Brad and having some laughs.
Yeah.
Those guys were like working you know, 24/7
doing the cells, because I guess all that's done on computer now. There's no reason. There's no guys sitting around inking, are there?
Yes, those guys draw. Those guys all draw, and then some of them do their stuff on the computer. But it's still a phenomenal thing, because you know they'll go, you know, so and so is like on fire. She did 3 seconds yesterday. It's like if they do a second a day of film time,
right.
A second.
That's crazy.
A day, then they're booking.
Wow.
So
what is it like? What's the storyline of this one?
Well, it's funny. This movie,
The Incredibles 2.
Incredibles 2, Brad, the feat of the movie is partly the complexity.
Yeah.
Because it does feel like there's about 5 movies.
Wow.
In one.
Yeah.
And he's able to weave them narratively together in a way that it's like they're necessary.
Right.
It's inevitable.
Have you seen it?
And I think the movie is dazzling. The movie takes place for like 14 seconds after the last movie.
Okay.
And it's 14 years, but in animated it's 14 seconds.
Okay.
Right. So, like, basically the family is in the exact same position of jeopardy that they were in when the last
movie ended. Picking up right there.
With the underminer, the bad guy, coming after us, coming after the city. You know, the superheroes are still illegal, and the parents still don't know that their youngest son, the infant, Jack-Jack, has crazy powers.
Right, right.
So they don't know that.
That he's really a superhero.
That he's a superhero himself.
Yeah.
They think that he's a normal baby.
Yeah, yeah. All right.
So you have all of
those. It's a common problem with parents.
Well, in fact, probably most parents would agree that their baby is like super in some weird way.
A genius.
Like a genius in terms of like never sleeping. But anyway, so that's where we start.
And like the first movie was incredibly popular. It's got a huge following, right?
The Incredibles operates on, it's not necessarily for children. I mean, it certainly is a movie that children can enjoy.
Yeah,
But Brad Bird, he's a bit of a genius.
Yeah.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah. Why? Because he can get all the balls in the air. He knows how to like really... Like he's one of those guys that it's expansive.
Yeah. He's kind of a high-low guy. I mean, he's got real highbrow, real lowbrow humor.
Right.
He operates on a kind of uber-sophisticated level, and visually it's really sophisticated.
Right. Well, that's the trick.
He has great passions, great visual loves.
Yeah.
And he's got a great... the Disney legacy, and he's a real historian. Animation.
So he's a Disney nerd, animation nerd.
Yeah, I mean he's got that's really where he comes from. He's highly educated about the history of animation.
Well, great.
Yeah,
bring a lot to it.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean it's sort of like, I mean, what's the interaction as an actor when you work with a animation director? Is he in the booth? I mean, what happens?
No, he's not in the booth. I mean, this is the only animated movie I've ever done. So these two. So I don't know how these
in
other
general?
Guys do this.
Yeah, because I've done voiceovers before, and they're generally like someone's usually there. You assume one of them's a director. I don't know. You know, like you're just in a room, and someone says, "Okay."
Yeah, they're talking to you a disembodied voice.
Yeah,
or even they're on the phone.
right. And they're like, okay, we're good, I think. That's it?
Right.
Yeah, you're good.
And they'll go, hold on just a second. And then there's silence because they're conferring.
Right.
But there's none of that is with this.
No.
Brad is in the room.
Oh, he's there.
He's right there. He's,
oh, okay. So you are.
He's you and I'm me, except we're both standing.
Oh, so he is directing you.
There's a microphone between us.
Right.
And it's just really, and he is the director.
Yeah.
And it's just between him and me. There is no conference. He's going, and he'll have a suggestion, and then he's like, great. And then we move on to the next scene.
Isn't it easier to make adjustments when it's just your voice? You know, and if a director goes, can you just give that to me a little, maybe tired? And you're like, yeah, no problem.
Absolutely.
As opposed to like,
I can be tired.
Yeah, but like when you're on a set with a bunch of moving parts and it's live action, you know, to sort of get a note and then reconfigure it into the entire scene, it's a big deal. But with the voice, it's just sort of like, yeah, sure, let's try it a couple times.
Well, I don't know, but the live action thing, yeah. Mark, that's what I do.
I know that.
I would never call it live action.
Well, I don't know. It's just acting. Right. I meant it as opposed to animated.
Right.
Right.
But live action, where did that word come from?
That's a knife.
I see that.
Yeah.
And it's got like places for your fingers.
Yeah. I don't know where it came from. I actually do, but it's not really.
It's an object.
I don't know where live action came from. I guess live action came from, at some point there were so many animated movies, you had to draw a line.
Yeah. Line must be drawn.
Right. It's a live action movie. Real people.
Right. Yeah. I always feel kind of sad when I find myself occasionally accidentally saying it.
What, live action?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you read Tree of Smoke?
I haven't read that, Dennis Johnson.
Dennis Johnson, he's great.
Great.
Oh, man.
Right?
Love him.
It's like really amazing books. Like,
yes.
I watched you, like you worked with my friend. Well, I guess we're friends. I mean, we're certainly contemporaries. Kumail and Emily, who I know well. You love it, huh?
Yeah, I love it.
You love doing that movie?
Yeah, I love those guys.
Yeah.
I miss those guys.
You do?
Yeah. I was just so funny. I was thinking about them this morning going, I miss them.
Do you? But you live in New York?
Yeah.
So when you come out here, do you have people you visit? You could have maybe dropped over, said hi.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I've got so many great tight friends in LA.
Yeah.
In some way, some of the greatest friends that I have live out here.
Yeah. From a life in show business.
That's right. LA collects great people.
Of course. Why do you stay in New York?
I love New York.
Yeah.
I can't get New York out of my head.
Are you in the city?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you still, you don't think it's changed a lot? Or
It's changed phenomenally.
And in good way or like you said?
I think Giuliani just wrung a lot of the edge out of the city.
Back then. But now, I don't even know. Right. I don't know. Yeah, I was there. I was there in the 80s. And I don't even know. Like, I don't
where
know.
Where were you? Where were you?
Second between A and B. What? 1989 through 1992. Yeah,
edge.
Yeah, it was a war zone back then. But now, like, you go there.
You were stepping over needles and stuff.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, yeah.
And there were point guys. There was a whole racket going. There was a doorway next to my house where they line up to get the dope. And now there's a nice cafe there. It's a nice little cafe there in that exact place.
Wow, that's...
Everything's changed.
Yes, everything is... And some of the edge, maybe it was nice to not have to look over your shoulder, like, constantly.
Well, I think that,
I think it's a little too soft.
Right. Well, when they did Times Square, there was, like...
That's tough.
But it is pretty spectacular. You know what I mean? Like, I think, I'm of two minds about it. Like, do we really miss the porno theaters and live sex shows and... You know, Port Authority being a complete fucking shit show.
But it still is.
Right.
Port Authority is like, wow. Do you remember that place?
What are you doing over there?
the Penn Station? Oh, yeah. My God.
Yeah.
Did they tore that down?
Did they tear Penn Station down?
Well, I mean, it was like...
It's under Madison Square Garden.
No,
right?
It was the one that was just like beyond magnificent. You got to see this documentary about it.
Oh, really?
You got to check. Well, I mean, it's truly mind-blowing. That they tore the old
building down.
Yeah,
yeah. I think that like Times Square, like it's touristy and it's weird, but
it's
lights
like
and
if
everything.
They took a wrecking ball to Grand Central Station.
Oh,
it
come
would be
on.
Exactly like
really?
Taking a wrecking ball to Grand Central Station. The
that sounds terrible.
The monumental
of Penn Station, the original Penn Station.
Yeah,
I don't.
It
I,
was.
I don't
it was much
it.
Bigger than Grand Central. It was a massive building.
I love Grand Central.
Yeah, me too.
I love going in there.
Well, it's just New York.
It's beautiful. So where'd you grow up, though?
In Georgia.
Georgia?
Yeah.
Like rural Georgia?
Yes.
City? Really?
Actually not that far from Atlanta, but it was, you know, I grew up on a farm.
And what'd they have on the farm?
Hay, cattle.
So it was a cattle farm?
Yes.
And your dad
and
was
hay.
Your family were cattle farmers?
No, my father was like a gentleman farmer, but
yeah.
The farm was a fully working operational gig. I mean, it was
right.
And both of my I've got two brothers who live and work on the farm.
Still?
Now. Yeah.
So it's the family farm is still intact.
Family farm is still happening.
Yeah, and like how many acres? How many cows?
Like a lot? 150 acres.
Oh my God!
No, sorry, 250 acres.
Wow!
And
it's huge.
You know, I don't know how many cows.
That's huge.
Cows they have. But for a farm, it's small. 250 acres is small when you've got the farms out in Texas that are like 30,000.
I guess so. That's true.
You know, it's pretty. You know.
And is it a dairy farm? They're
beef.
So they make meat. They're meat cows.
Yeah. Meat cows, often referred to as beef caught cows.
Yeah, beef cows. That's fine. And you, did you work on the farm as a kid?
No.
Not at all?
No, my father was a true blue sexist.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
No working on
farms. Girls did not do that kind of thing. Girls should wear dresses and help their mother set the table.
Uh-huh, so that's what you did.
That's right.
And what'd your mother do? Just the older version of that?
An older version of setting the table. Yeah.
Making the food.
My mom, you know, she was a what do you call it? She was a housewife.
Yeah, that's what
you call
it.
My mom did.
A farmer's wife, it
sounds
like.
Yeah, she was really, not a farmer's wife. She was a housewife.
Yeah.
She was a 50s housewife. You know, very, very much in that tradition.
Yeah. Yeah, and did, so your brothers are older or younger?
All older. I'm the youngest.
There's three of you?
No, there's five brothers and one sister.
Really? You have five brothers and a sister? So there's seven altogether? Are they all still around?
They are. They are.
Is everybody friends?
Yes.
Oh, that's good.
We see each other. You know, actually, we all got together for the big sick.
Uh-huh.
So,
did they love the movie?
Yeah, they loved it.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, yeah.
It's nice to hear about families that kind of keep getting along and everybody's, no one else is in show business.
No.
So they're all excited
for you. Well, look,
you
know, I think it's important to, I mean, for me personally, it's really important to kind of, to keep that connection.
Yeah.
I think you have to make compromises. Uh-huh. There are things that you don't want to discuss, you know. There's stuff that you don't want to have come up. Yeah. Money and politics are generally two good things not to talk about.
Yeah.
And it's also, but it's fairly easy to avoid those topics.
Is it?
Even in this day and age, I can absolutely avoid both of them with ease.
But no one's pushing your buttons?
My buttons are not really pushable. It's just like, and I step aside.
Yeah. You're not going to do it.
No, because for me, the priorities are really firmly in place. It's like I'm an adult and
right.
I can handle it.
I can handle it, and I don't need to talk to you about that.
Right.
You know, this conversation is over. I love you. Let's eat dessert.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know. Let's.
And they know. Everyone knows.
Yeah.
You know,
and they get it. They I think everybody's, you know, obviously, if you still have a connection with your immediate family.
Right.
For the length of, you know, your entire adult life.
Yeah.
It's because people have a certain, you know, they got priorities and they've got boundaries and everybody understands, you know, what the lineup is, which
right.
is you want to keep this intact.
That's right. And as long as you don't lose
it's important.
Yeah. Right. And as long as you don't lose your shit. Cause some drama that could last for 3-4 years, 10.
Right. Or 20.
20.
Yeah, you want to avoid the 20-year
fight.
Meltdown.
Yeah, just the one meltdown that lasted 20 years.
Yeah, that turns into that weirdness.
That hasn't happened.
That most people, like, people have some at least 6 degrees of separation contact with that kind of fallout.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you want to avoid it. Yeah.
I've gone years without talking to my dad at some point. I don't know that I lost those years. He's still around, so it doesn't feel like I made a tremendous mistake.
Right.
Just had to be done at the time.
Right. Sometimes these things, they're inevitable.
Yeah. So, I mean, I imagine, well, I'm projecting. I imagine that because you're from the South that there are some lines that are drawn politically that must be challenging. You're speechless?
So what else can we talk about?
not even going to talk to me about it. That's all right.
No, I mean, wow. That's
the
huge.
Tough one. Yeah, it's
that's
tough.
Huge.
Yeah, it's
and,
tough.
And the lines that are drawn, you know, from one state to another now seems so massive. And so,
yeah, it's
kind of
a trip, right?
But, you know, Georgia, it's very interesting.
Yeah, because Atlanta's like, I mean, I work in Atlanta.
So but Georgia could, you know, because of the black vote, yeah. I mean, Georgia could turn blue again.
Sure.
But I was just trying to, because people are so, there's been a lot of activation about,
sure.
You know.
Reaction.
Yes.
Everyone's like waking up.
People are woke.
Yeah.
And Georgia is experiencing that big time.
Yeah.
So it's kind of going from violently red to possibly blue.
Yeah. It's exciting. It's exciting when Americans all of a sudden realize that maybe they have to engage in the political process.
I know, man.
You know what I mean? It's very hard as a, you know, even for me, where you just sort of like, what have we been doing for 30 years?
I know. It takes a state of emergency.
Exactly. And
that's unfortunate.
For almost anything to happen.
I know. Does it have to, do we have to go this far?
Yeah. We don't, but it's sort of like, I think people just get disconnected, detached, you know, bored with the political process. They get the thing in the mail. They're like, oh, I don't even know I'm going. Who's this guy? What is that job?
I need a glass of wine.
Sure. Yeah. I need some wine. I'm not going to make it over to the voting place. It's dirty. Can't we just do it at home? Yeah, you can if you send the thing in. Oh, did that already come? Yeah, it's probably. So did you, when you left Georgia, were you like, I got to get the fuck out of here?
Although, I would say that's true. I love living in New York.
Yeah.
And I don't have any desire to live in the South again, except I will say I find New Orleans an incredibly seductive original city.
Right?
You
it's
know,
hold the, it's like
New
its
Orleans
own thing.
New Orleans is its own thing, and I find it really powerful. Mm-hmm. When I go there, it's just like the pull is it's just so beautiful.
It's almost mystical.
Mystical.
Right?
So, and I hope New Orleans never loses that. It doesn't seem like it's going to.
Yeah. It's, I was there not too long ago. I didn't feel like it was like, this isn't the same. There's still that thing.
Great, man.
Well, just the thing, like just looking at the buildings, it's like there's nothing like these buildings anywhere. It's like down to the architecture. Like, there's nothing. This isn't.
What were you
thing.
Doing down there?
I did a show. I did a stand-up show a couple years ago, I guess, and walked around a bit.
Like doing stand-up?
I do it a lot. Yeah. I do it. Yeah, I like doing it.
Do you come
job.
To New York?
Yeah, sure.
Do you go to Comedy Cellar? I mean, where do you?
I do the Cellar sometimes. Yeah, I used to go there a lot when
and
I lived
And do you
in New
like
York.
The intimacy of the Cellar? I mean, how?
I like making.
Or do you like the bigness? Do you like going to the Beacon?
I like making a place the size of the Beacon intimate. That's what the challenge that I've taken upon myself. I was just at Royal Festival Hall in London. It's about 2,600, and I like bringing it in to where it feels intimate. I mean, that's been the evolution of what I try to do, as opposed to rising to the space. Let's bring the space in.
And how do you do that? I mean,
sit down. You know, you sit down, you talk directly to people.
Cool.
Right. You know, it's like, how much energy do you want to exert? And, you know, what's the quality of laugh that you want? You know, how much you want to be engaged? I think it's a matter of engagement and taking emotional risks that create an intimacy, not just, you know, going beat to beat. That's like theater.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I immediately just kind of thought about Spalding Gray.
Right.
And
yeah, that's a good model.
Spalding would just kind of bring it. He would just bring it into him. He would just be sitting at that desk.
Right.
You know,
that's
and
it.
Talking to people.
Yep.
It was just like he controlled, you know, he controlled the closeness. And he made it. He demanded that it be close.
I think if I could cite somebody that does something that I find that I would aspire to, it'd certainly be that. Yeah. And he's not.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, and I think you can do it with any space. I really do. I think theaters are built for that in a certain way. They kind of crave intimacy. That the idea of spectacle is a whole other thing. You know, if you're a rock concert or whatever. But, you know, if you're in a theater, you know, you've done theater. So when you get out there, that it's visceral. You can feel the presence of the audience. You have a sense of their investment and their emotional attention. And when you just talk, like to talk off a mic in a big space, people are like, what's happening?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, just to sit down at the Beacon is, that's kind of a radical act. I think that's cool.
I did it at Carnegie 2 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And it was
Carnegie. Wasn't that wonderful? Didn't you love the feeling?
Yeah, I think I should have had, I did love the feeling, but like I it took me a while to get grounded because I was nervous and emotional and I couldn't believe I was there. And I was sort of, you know, winging it a little bit for about like a half hour. I was just floundering around. But once I leveled, but that was another situation where I'm like, I got to make this intimate. And there was a point in the show where, you know, I wanted, my dad had sent me a text that I thought was hilarious, but I'd left my phone backstage and I wanted to read it. So I was in a very improvisational place, even at Carnegie Hall. And I was asking someone to bring me my phone from backstage and no one heard me. So it became this little mystery in the middle of the show. Like, are they going to bring it? Is this going to happen?
Am I talking?
Yeah, exactly. And then someone appeared.
Can
at
you
the
hear
door.
Me?
Exactly. It was that. And when they finally showed up, it was a very exciting moment for everybody.
Wow. So, and yeah. Did you feel the acoustic? I mean, did you feel the wood
definitely.
Of the liveness of that room?
Definitely.
As opposed to the Beacon?
I've never done the Beacon yet. But definitely, you definitely feel Carnegie. You feel the whole history of it. You know, there's like...
Totally.
I
can imagine. I can only imagine what that must be like to look out. I mean, because I love to go to Carnegie.
It's like
and
circular.
Watch.
Yeah, it's like sort of. Yeah, I love places where you can hear, you know, like that are designed for instruments. You know, where you can hear like just anything.
So, what about Disney?
Oh yeah, I've only been there once. I've not seen a show there. I've not seen the symphony. I would go. Yeah, I like Lincoln Center. I've performed in opera houses. Like you don't like Lincoln Center? You don't
but not Disney here.
You I know,
got the,
it's pretty,
the creme de la creme. I mean, Disney
is
unbelievable.
Is it the creme de la creme? Oh.
Yeah, man.
Have you been there?
Oh, yeah. Tons. I mean, I love to go to Disney.
Yeah.
Whenever I'm in L.A., I try to go to I mean, Esa-Pekka Salonen.
Yeah.
And then you guys got Dudamel.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's not
two
really
of the greatest conductors in the world.
Yeah, I got to get more into it.
You guys have.
I know. But I don't know that world. Like, a lot of times, if I'm in New York, I've started to go to see the jazz. You know, over to see Marsalis and those guys at Jet Lincoln Center.
Right.
And then like, but I just do it. I don't plan it. Like if I'm in the city and I'm like, you know, I got a little money, you know, what's over there? You know, like I did that at Lincoln Center. I don't know. It's like, all right. So they're playing a little bit of Beethoven and some other shit. I don't know these people, but how bad could it be? It's at Lincoln Center. Right? So you just pay the...
But I would say, I mean, if you could see Dudamel here.
Yeah.
Dudamel is just, he's such a visceral conductor.
Yeah.
I mean, I think he brings out like a, he's a world-class guy.
Yeah.
You know, he's like, he's very visceral. I think the kind of music that he draws from musicians is really, he's got a really global influence. He loves, you know, a real international sound from his musicians. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, he would be a great guy.
I'll go.
To just go listen to and watch.
I appreciate you.
What he does.
Yeah, I appreciate you telling me to do that.
I mean, I'm really jealous that L.A. has him and that New York doesn't.
Well, now I feel like just an asshole, an unsophisticated
idiot. No, man. It's a treat. You're going to get to go to Disney Music Hall with one of the great conductors, you know.
Uh-huh.
And who brings
I'm excited.
Kind of an earthy feeling to classical music.
But do you know classical music well?
No, not really.
But you just like that dude.
But I like the LA, Phil.
All right, well I'm going to go because like I've been wondering how to enjoy life and this seems like a step in the right direction.
You know, definitely go there and you can then you can also check out the space and go, "Hey, you know, you could perform there."
Oh, I don't know.
Because that would be incredible.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you would probably adore that.
It might be. It might be exciting. I performed at the Symphony Hall in San Francisco, which is another big, huge acoustic space.
I don't know that.
Well, here's the issue. Like, I learned a weird lesson. You know, it's about 1,900 seats, but like, it's a space where they do comedy sometimes. For whatever reason, if you can get people in there, I sold okay. But there's a giant organ that it's always there, and it takes up the entire back of the wall. And I felt that, you know, subconsciously people were expecting something bigger. So when I did this face, I did this at Royal Festival Hall in England. And again, I walk out.
The organ.
It's a fucking organ.
Well, and at Disney Music Hall, you would have the same thing.
Right. So, but they said to me, they said, we can put a curtain in front of the organ. I'm like, would you? Because I've had experiences with organs this size.
Just like go play a couple of notes and just like.
Maybe, but I don't even know where the keyboard was. All you see are those pipes.
I know, it's true.
Where is it? Like, I don't know where the guy sits.
It's unbelievably mysterious.
So when you were in New York, did you work with Spalding?
No. Well, you know, it's so wild that one of my first experiences that I ever had was with Spalding when he was with Richard Schechter and the original Worcester group.
Yeah.
But this was like 1977.
Uh-huh.
I was in Pittsburgh going to Carnegie Mellon University, and the Worcester group and Spalding came through town. And
oh,
they
really?
Did a workshop with us. Because I was at an acting conservatory.
That's one of the big ones. That was
yeah. So he came and the Worcester group did a workshop with us, and then he was unforgettable. And then they performed three plays over that weekend. So we saw them perform, and then we worked. But it was unforgettable for me.
Yeah. What left the biggest impression?
His improvisatory freedom.
Uh-huh.
His intuitions. I mean, things would come to him, and it would just be impulse. He would have an impulse, and then he would act on the impulse. And that's something that actors, you want. You know, you court that.
Yeah.
That thoughtless kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought that he mastered that.
As a monologist, but I mean, I wonder, like...
No, but this was kind of as an actor, as an improviser.
Okay, yeah, right. But, like, it's harder to do that in character, I would think.
Well, he really wasn't thinking about character.
Right.
He was thinking about, like, circumstances.
He would
pose these circumstances to us and then, and put some conflicts in for us, some obstacles, and then we would deal.
So
it wouldn't be like doing a part.
Right,
it would be like just dealing with this, conflict.
Yeah, the improvisation of the immediate. Right.
Right.
It's happening now.
I just thought he was kind of, really a profound artist that I was seeing really young in my, or very early on in my studies.
And did you meet him again later to tell him that he had this amazing impact on you?
No.
Never?
I saw him, several times, but I never went backstage.
Oh.
I was too intimidated.
So Carnegie Mellon, how'd you end up there? So did you do theater in Georgia early on when you were younger? You did.
Yeah, I sometimes I forget. I'm just like nodding my head. And you're like, Molly, you got to talk.
She's nodding her head now. That's a yes. That silence is
a
yes.
A translator. A verbal translator. Yeah.
But you did, yeah.
She's tired of talking.
Are you tired of talking?
No, but so do people just play with all these kind of fun things that you have?
Certain people do.
I mean, this is a hammer.
It's a half a hammer.
Split handle is very provocative.
It is provocative.
Cropsy. It's like this should be in a horror film.
Yeah, it might be. Might be.
If you put a little blood.
Sure, you're all set. Yeah, some people play. Sometimes I wonder why they play. But I like having
things
out there.
Do you think, wow, they're playing because they're nervous? Or...
I think it's a comforting thing,
they
usually.
They wish they had a cigarette, or what is it?
Something. Yeah.
Are they bored?
I don't mind if people smoke, if they want to smoke. But I don't know if they're bored. I think it's a way of...
It's an anxiety.
Anxiety, and also sort of like, it's distracting.
Hey, and you know what this looks like?
What's
Mosaic
it?
Man?
Yeah, it's a mosaic mushroom.
Is this Mosaic Man?
No. That was a fan made that. They put the name of the podcast, and they put a little cat on top.
And Mosaic Man in the East Village?
Oh, yeah. He does them all over the lights.
Right,
so
right.
Oh, that's right. That guy. I don't think that's his work, but I do. When I go to New York, I like it.
Definitely inspired by him.
So,
anyway, yeah.
Acting.
So acting. Ah, yes, acting.
So, try to get a little.
The subject that I warm to.
But in Georgia, what were you doing? Just like high school stuff or?
Just high school stuff.
But you knew you wanted to do
musicals. I was, in high school musicals.
I would love to see you in a high school musical.
So then I was a director, saw me in a high school play, and he was the director of the Alliance Theater in Atlanta, which is the Atlanta's big theater, and he did repertory theater in upstate New York.
Oh yeah,
summer rep.
Sure.
And so he said, "Do you want to come to my summer rep company and apprentice?" This was when journeyman. This was when you apprenticed. When
you learned how to clean things and build things and serve food and
wash people's underwear.
Oh well, that's a. You sure that everyone did that?
And I had to. And I helped actors off the stage in the dark, and I turned the turntables in between scenes, and all that crazy stuff that apprentices do.
Did you love it?
I loved it.
And what were some of the shows? Who were some of the actors you walked off stage? Did you meet people that impressed you? Was life changing when you saw this people on the stage?
You know, it was the first time that I had encountered a gay community that I knew was a gay community.
Uh-huh.
And that gay community knew that they were gay.
Yeah.
So that when I went back to my high school, I went, oh, wow, he's gay. You know, one of my classmates.
But did they know?
He's gay and he doesn't know it.
Uh-huh.
And he may never know it the way that I know.
Yeah, right. Or he may never be as comfortable as the people I met up there.
That's right.
It's almost a sad feeling for that person.
But it was an exciting awakening for me because there were all these like incredibly theatrical, at home, fun.
Yeah. You just wanted to take the gay guy you knew in high school and bring him up there.
Yeah,
and
I know. Hey,
run
man.
Run wild.
It's okay.
Right.
So, there were a lot of really fun, impressive people, and I went, oh, I want to do this. This is
you
a
want
world.
To become part of the theater.
I want to be part of this world.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. And you did. You became that.
So and what I was, became that.
What were some of the shows, though, that you were able to see? Like, because Summer Stock's always a little odd. The tour.
No, it is funny.
It is funny?
Well, I mean, we did Gypsy, we did Anything Goes, we did Cabaret, we did,
But so you didn't have celebrities coming in to do shows? It was just a group?
Just a group of, you know, and some professional actors were coming through.
Right.
But it wasn't like, it didn't have that kind of high profile. But for me, that didn't matter. This was the life.
And so that after you did that, you were never the same again, and you knew you had to leave.
Well, you know, I was just like, can I come back? So they invited me back to the second, summer.
To apprentice.
When I was 16.
Yeah.
So I was 15, and then when I was 16, I went back. And then I just said, where should I go to study to be a professional? Where should I study?
Yeah.
And they... at that, it was, I don't even know why, but they all said Carnegie Mellon.
Yeah.
All those guys said Carnegie is the place to go. So that was the only school that I applied to. I put everything in that basket.
Sure.
And, you know.
You got it.
Well, so thank God, because maybe I would just be a secretary in Atlanta.
Yeah, a very, very exciting secretary.
Right.
Very intense.
Taking, dictation. Very dramatic secretary.
Why is she all worked up all the time?
Yeah, wow. She's just, she seems...
What a pip.
She seems really...
very intense about the... She answers the phone very intensely.
So unfulfilled.
Yeah. So you did undergrad at Carnegie Mellon. Is that how it works? You there for 4 years?
Right.
And that was, that might have been like, I don't know when the other, Yale is Yale, but that's a graduate program. Juilliard, that's a graduate program. So you won.
No, Juilliard's undergrad too.
Oh yeah?
They do the undergrad as well.
Probably lucky you didn't go there.
But I'm really happy.
Yeah.
I'm just happy that I didn't go straight from the farm to New York City. It was very nice to have a pit stop in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, Pittsburgh's all right.
Pittsburgh's all right, and it was a great little way station, because New York would have been too intense for me. And Carnegie feels a little bit more like a little womb. It's a little
you
safe.
Need it.
It's a safe place
to learn and see Spalding Gray come down and get your mind blown in a safe environment before you go get beat up.
Yeah, New York in 1976.
Ugh.
Probably,
exciting.
It was, I mean, I was ready for it by 1980. But 76, just give me 4 years.
Is that when you went to, when did you get out of Carnegie Mellon?
80.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, I hit New York, and New York had, like, all the edge that we were talking about.
Yeah, just you caught the last wind of it.
Well, I would say the 80s. The 80s had some nice.
I guess that's true, you know, because a lot of the, you know, a lot of the performance art stuff that was going on was still kind of doing it then.
And Soho was still very much an artist, you know, enclave.
Right.
They were getting ready to be pushed out, you know.
Right.
But a lot of those buildings didn't have certificate of occupancy.
Sure.
I mean, all this, you know, all that stuff was still happening.
So when you went up there, did you have a sense of how show business was supposed to work? Did you know what you were to do? When you left Carnegie, when you moved to New York, or were you just sort of like, I'm here with my headshot?
I came there with my headshot and a real sense of entitlement.
Which is necessary when you start to be in show business. You need to be delusional and maintain it for as long as possible.
Well, didn't you feel that way?
Of course. Why else would anyone fucking do this?
Right.
You know,
you need to have a certain amount of fearlessness. Like, hey, man, I get to be here.
Yeah. And also, like, it'll come. I just got to show up. You know?
Right. It's a certain kind of, you know, as you get older, it's willful naivete. But at that point, it's just naivete.
Well, I don't know what other kind of person really takes the chance. You know, anybody who's sort of like, I'm going to try it. It's like, no, well, that's not going to work out.
Well, you're pretty much not going to go, you know what, I'm going to give stand-up a real whirl at the age of 45.
Yeah, no, believe me, it happens. I've seen it happen. But no, the bigger problem is like, what if all that self-will and delusion that you need to sort of propel yourself into such a ridiculous profession, what if it doesn't work out? That's the sad story.
That's a sad story, but then, of course, you know, sadness, you know, strikes us all sooner or later. I mean, you're going to get the ebb, you're going to get the flow.
Yeah.
And some get it, or you know, earlier than others.
Yes, there's no happy ending for anyone.
Right? Nobody gets out of here.
That's right.
And so,
when you get to New York, so what do you do? Who, like, what's your first move? Who are your pals? What's happening?
I didn't really. Well, I had a few pals, but I think, you know, I met this casting director, Joy Todd.
Yeah.
And she just went. She just liked me.
Uh huh.
And she started giving me extra work.
Oh, yeah?
So I just did a lot of extra work.
You
instead
did?
Instead of having to wait tables, extra work.
Okay.
So you could make, you know, $100 a day, $200 a day.
Right, and also you could be on a set. You
could
get
be
a
on
sense
a set. I didn't really care so much about that, but the money was nice.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
I wasn't fighting for the front. I wasn't fighting for camera time. Like, not at all.
You weren't walking by several times? There's that girl again.
Yeah, no, I didn't. That was not my
MO. What were you thinking? You wanted to do theater, or were you thinking, like, what was the plan there?
I wanted to do theater.
That was it?
Yeah.
You weren't even thinking in terms of movies or TV. You're like, this is garbage. Where's the theater?
No, I didn't think that it was garbage at all. I just, like, it was the theater. That was what I
trained for.
Wanted to do. But hey, I didn't have any problems with movies or television. I mean, none. I wanted to be an actress.
Right.
But I did move to L.A.
Right.
I did move
to New York. Right.
Yeah.
On purpose.
It was a stage thing. But I had no, you know, I wasn't I wasn't snooty.
Yeah.
About like, oh.
Yeah.
Television.
Where'd you live in New York when you first got there?
Like, where didn't I live?
Oh, really?
I mean, but, you know, those were like I said, you know, it was 80.
Yeah.
So you could be an out of work actor and live in Manhattan.
Sure.
You could do that.
Yeah.
I mean, I had five roommates.
Oh, yeah. Where was that place?
On like 60, between 66th and 67th on Columbus.
Oh, up there.
But then, you know, I was on Amsterdam and 73rd, right, you know, across from Needle Park.
Uh-huh.
Then I was in the Bronx, the North Bronx.
Yeah.
Then I was in 9th Street between 2nd and 3rd, which was groovy.
That's nice.
Not
down
far
there.
From you.
Yeah, yeah. 9th Street, yeah. By Tompkins Square.
Then I was, you know, Morton and Hudson.
Oh, yeah. Other side.
Then 11th and...
Wow, really.
Fifth and University.
And
I mean, you move around a lot when you're young and you're living in New York City.
Yeah.
You're moving.
Yeah. Because you just meet people. You're like, all right, you got a room? I'm tired of living with these nine people. How many people do you live with?
Right. Yeah. Okay, the North Bronx is dull.
Yeah.
Let's get off the D train.
Right. So when did you start getting work?
Well, I got a horror movie.
Yeah.
Within 3 weeks
of being in New York.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I got this horror film, yeah. and actually with that Harvey Weinstein.
Oh yeah.
Was his first movie that he ever produced.
Right when he got out of the music business.
He was a concert promoter.
Yeah.
Right. And in fact, we were up in Buffalo in North Tonawanda, New York. And the Commodores came through town. Harvey was so we went and saw the Commodores
because Harvey was promoting concerts,
right?
And was he a monster yet?
You know, I had many dealings with Harvey.
Yeah.
Harvey obviously was a monster. I didn't see that for a long time.
Yeah.
And the monstrous part of Harvey that I was privy to was his temper, which he has a mighty one.
Uh-huh.
But
how did that come out in your experience?
At the Cannes Film Festival, which, you know, Harvey was a kind of a permanent fixture at.
Uh-huh. But not directed at you?
No, yeah, directed at me, sure. But Harvey, you know, he could be very sloppy with all
everything.
Things.
Yeah.
With everything.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, so I did The Burning.
Yeah.
And got so much money. I mean, I was like sleeping in cash. You know,
really?
I would just like wake up with bills from my per diem.
Wow.
I just couldn't believe how much money, you know, I was making on The Burning. It was 1980. I'd been in New York for 3 weeks and it was raining.
Give me
cash.
A number amount. This sounds crazy.
It was
for
like,
a small
you know,
movie.
I made like $1,000.
Yeah.
You know, and it was like incredible.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was like so happy.
You're a working actress and it's raining money.
Right.
$1,000.
Right.
I'm going to move to a place with only two other people in it.
And that is what happened. And I just got a roommate.
Who is that?
Jason Alexander, you know,
sure.
Seinfeld.
He's been in here.
And Jason and I got a place on Amsterdam between 73 and 74.
Really? You lived with Jason Alexander? You lived with Jason Alexander?
Yeah, me and Jason. And Jason's wife, eventual wife, moved in with us for a little while.
Uh-huh.
And then they moved out and got married.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so it was just me and Jason.
Did you guys get along? Did you?
We were pals.
Yeah.
We were good pals.
He's a sweet guy. I've talked to him in here. We did a really great episode about acting.
Very sweet.
Yeah.
Very sweet. And he was doing musical theater. He was kind of a musical theater actor.
Yeah. Big Mac, the commercial, the McDonald's commercial he did. Yeah, I pulled that up and we talked about
it. I'm not surprised.
His Tim dancing.
Jason would be a total natural.
Yeah, he's just a dancer, yeah. So, okay, so then what happens after The Burning?
Then I went into a period of not working.
After the raining money, $1,000.
Right.
No,
then I had to, like, you know, hit the deck with, you know, waitressing.
You did?
Yeah.
Which place?
Chip's Pub. And then after I got fired from Chip's Pub, then I, you know, I started temping,
yeah,
you know,
sure.
You know,
yeah,
doing and I did secretarial stuff at HBO.
Oh, yeah.
I was a temp.
On Bryant Park? Was that what
no,
it was?
No. Not far on Sixth Ave.
Yeah. Exactly.
And then I got a play. And once I got the play,
yeah,
then I just started doing plays.
Was it a big play? What'd you do?
It was an off Broadway play.
Uh-huh.
But it was a, you know, really cool play.
You could work.
Yeah, it
get
was a
it.
Really fun play. And that was, and then I started just doing plays.
Almost like, just almost all theater, huh?
Yeah, I just went from one play to another and did that for, you know, for a couple of years and got a Broadway play. And
which one?
Crimes of the Heart.
Oh, that's big.
And then Joel and Ethan Coen saw Crimes of the Heart.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, I got to know those guys. They were doing Blood Simple.
Uh-huh. Was the Coen married to Francis yet?
No. Fran and I were rooming. Fran and I were roommates.
You were?
Yeah.
That must have been an intense household.
Up in the North Bronx.
I just can't imagine the two of you just running around.
Just
the apartment.
Like an effortless friendship.
I'm sure.
And so Fran and I were up in the North Bronx, and I, you know, I met Joel and Ethan, and then they met Fran, and then they did Blood Simple, and then we all did Raising Arizona.
Were you
know
in
what
Blood
I mean?
Simple? You did. Oh, you had a little So that you did you facilitate the meeting of Fran and
I said you should meet my roommate,
and that's how it started. She's married to Joel, right?
Yeah.
I can't. And wasn't she involved with the Worcester Group at the time?
And no. But Fran is deeply involved in the Worcester Group presently.
Now, right?
I mean, she's done stuff with them through the course of these last, you know.
Yeah, but not when you were roommates.
No.
You were just work trying to get jobs.
No, Fran's involvement with the Worcester Group was later.
Okay. Yeah. So that's exciting. So you meet these Coen brothers before they even start. You're around with their first movie.
That's right.
Yeah. And then they give you the lead in their second movie.
Right. That's right. So, and Fran is in the second movie too.
Oh yes, I remember.
And I'm in the answering machine in Blood Simple. You know, there's an answering machine that comes up, and I'm on. My voice is on the answering machine.
Right. I love Raising Arizona.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, I mean, it was so funny and so wild, and like how now you've worked with them then and later. So how did they work at the time they did Blood Simple? Because I just talked to Josh Brolin about working with them. And I'm just curious about how that process is. I mean, was it different working with them on Raising Arizona and then, you know, Oh Brother, where, I mean, you know, what's the, have you, can you see the evolution in their process?
You know, oddly, not really.
Uh-huh.
Joel and Ethan are highly original.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, an exception.
Yeah.
To any rule, really.
Yeah.
They feel slightly impervious to stress. I mean, things might annoy them.
Right.
But they have a real, it's a feeling of, they've got a safety. Maybe it's because they have each other, but
right.
They feel, like I said, it's a certain kind of, it's impenetrable in terms of the stress of the normal stress levels that people experience in making a movie.
Yeah.
I just think that you know, there's a confidence there.
Yeah, right. They're in total control.
Totally exhibited in, I'm sure they exhibited in Blood Simple. They certainly, it was there in Raising Arizona. And it was, I felt like almost identical. Oh Brother, and I was cut out of Miller's Crossing.
But like Raising Arizona, like I know it's a long time ago, but like everybody was so hilarious and kind of like, you know, Nicolas Cage at that point was so young and beautiful.
I know.
And just so fucking funny. John Goodman.
I know.
I mean, it's like, it must be wild to look back at that and just be like, oh my God.
Yeah, it's just a really funny movie.
It really is.
It's just really funny.
And I'd read somewhere that they based Nicolas Cage's character on Wile E. Coyote.
Well, no, that was Nicolas.
Oh, he did.
Nick did that. Oh. That was the Cage influence. He brought that in.
He did.
And they, like, couldn't deny it.
Oh, right.
I mean, Nick is very committed, and he lived that.
Uh-huh.
You know?
He did.
He walked the walk, and Joel and Ethan were like, yes.
Uh-huh. Wow. So did you love working with him?
Nick?
Yeah.
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 I don't know. I'm in awe of Nick.
Yeah.
I think he's like there's nobody like that guy.
I know.
I mean, what Nick keeps showing up with over the decades is incredible.
Yeah.
The chances that Nick can take, the ability that Nick has is kind of, I feel like it's without limit.
Yeah.
I mean, like what can the guy not do?
I guess that's true, huh?
I do. I feel that way about him. I mean, David Gordon Green did this movie called Joe.
Yeah, I heard about this.
And I
yeah.
thought that Nick was, you know, so beautiful in it.
I was just talking to Lynn Shelton about that the other night. I've not seen that movie.
Yeah, it's a very difficult thing because David Gordon Green likes to work with a bunch of non-actors.
Yeah.
And that's a hard intersection to like make, to be cool with.
Yeah.
If you're working with non-actors in a way to be as good as them can be hard.
Right. Because they're just doing the one thing they do.
Because, they're just
being.
Being.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's all you want to, that's all you're aspiring to do.
Yeah.
And so I thought Nick just did that so gracefully.
Wow. And do you talk to him?
I haven't seen or talked to Nick in years, but whenever we run into each other, there's, I think, great affection.
Like we went to high school together kind of thing?
Well, I think that, you know, because the success of Raising Arizona, it had a strange kind of shape.
Uh-huh.
Because initially it was not a successful movie.
Right.
It became beloved over
right.
the decades.
Oh, I guess that's true, huh? Yeah.
Yeah. And it was at the beginning of both of our careers.
At a very vital time for
right.
each other. You were there.
Right.
And then, like, you took off and then, like, Broadcast. You, like, it seems to me like I feel like I grew up with you because I see you in movies so much. But Broadcast News, another, like, because you take a lot of chances, too. I mean, when you say that about Nicolas Cage, I mean, when I was looking at the films you've done, I mean, you don't shy away from going out there.
Thank you.
I mean, like, you know, like Crash. I mean, that's
that
heavy.
Was fun.
That's heavy shit, you know, and even The Firm, which I love that movie. I love The Firm. And I thought you were great in that.
Yeah, thanks.
And I don't think these are safe things. And well, obviously the piano, but those aren't, there's nothing safe about how you approach acting. It's very exciting.
Thank you.
And like when I think of like the like you and Francis together, I'm like, oh my God, how can one room contain that? So you, you know what I mean? But let's like move through a couple of things. Like when you do something like The Firm, who I'd, working with all these different directors, like someone like Sidney Pollack, who you know, was kind of amazing. How do you judge directors in terms of like the work? I mean, do most of them just hire you and expect you to just do what you do? Or do are there ones that that really kind of work with you through things?
I mean, I think that, you know, a great director, a really great director, casts magnificently
right.
and then steps out of the way so that, you know, and really, I think, what most actors want is the director to provide an environment, you know, an atmosphere that feels right for that story.
Yeah.
That's supportive of the story.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, sure.
And that feels, for me, I love it if I feel, just in general, if I feel loved by a director.
Yeah.
You know, if I feel that the director really admires these actors.
Yeah.
And I mean, I've worked with some directors who were a fabulous audience, like my dream audience.
Yeah.
And that can kind of inspire a better performance.
Yeah, I bet.
I don't want it to be a negative atmosphere.
Right.
Like if somebody is a screamer,
yeah,
that's hard.
And that happens?
I don't like, I won't deal with that.
Yeah.
That's not conducive.
It's abusive.
It's abusive.
Right.
So that's got to stop.
Right.
I don't truck.
Have you walked off sets before because of someone's insanity?
No, I just take them quietly aside. I just take them to somewhere and say, listen, man, you got to go back and apologize to everybody. I mean,
yeah.
Now you got to say you're sorry because right. we can't.
Yeah, you're going to ruin everything.
Yeah, now you got to go do that.
Yeah.
And you probably don't want to, but that's the only way that everybody's going to be able to stay on board with you. And you need us. You know, you need us to stay on board with you to do this movie. You know, I mean, I don't want to fight fire with fire in those situations. I want to fight fire with a certain amount of love.
Yeah.
And say, like, you lost your shit.
Yeah.
And everybody has. And now, you know, you can make it right.
I feel like just you just saying that right now, I feel like I should try to make something right.
Can you?
I just want to apologize for everything I've ever done.
That's so great. Well, we can go on. Right. But anyway, I mean, yeah sometimes, I mean, I would never want to direct. It looks like a nightmare.
Mm.
It looks like a nightmare, a mountain of stress.
And working with, like, you, like the piano obviously was a wild movie, and that's a long time ago, but like, yeah, I mean, you won the big thing. Was that great?
Yeah, no, listen, that was great.
Yeah.
And I love Jane.
Yeah.
I love Campion.
Yeah.
I love Harvey.
Yeah, Harvey, yeah. Have you worked with him again?
No.
Like, he's like a trip, man.
I love Harvey.
Yeah. I mean, what an odd part for him, too.
Really, no, I mean, you know, I see Harvey, we start crying.
You do?
Yeah, I mean, we fall into each other's arms. Oh, I mean, I love him.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And was that the first time you met him, was on the set of that thing?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
It was. That's the first time I ever met him.
I
hold Harvey close.
He's another one that takes real chances. Like, for just a kid from New York, I mean, he really does a thing.
I know, man.
It's crazy.
I mean, I'm looking forward to seeing this movie that he did with Scorsese and De Niro. And
oh, the Italian movie?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is it done?
I don't know, but
I heard about
whenever it.
It
is, I'm going to go see it.
And what about the movie 13, which I thought, I love that movie too.
Oh, me too.
What a, it's a, kind of a harsh movie, but really great.
Really beautiful. I mean, Catherine Hardwicke, wow. She did such an incredible thing.
Yeah.
Such a, she's out, she really took risks. She had this thing, you know, she, it was like when I met her, I went, okay, this is the girl to direct this movie.
Yeah.
I don't know what this movie is.
Yeah.
But I want to be part of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, because she, I just felt like I was going to be on her ride.
Yeah. It's, yeah, it's, it, it was raw, man. Right?
It was raw.
Yeah.
And very articulate.
I thought so. Like, it made an impact on me. So, like, outside of the, do you still, do you like doing any more theater? Do you still do theater?
Or I did a play that the great David Rabe wrote.
Oh, wow.
He did, he was.
Streamers was his.
Streamers. Play.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And Hurley Burley.
Oh, Hurley Burley,
And he also direct, he wrote a play called Sticks and Bones that I did about 3 years ago at the New Group, which is an off-Broadway.
Yeah.
And I just recently saw his latest play, Good for Otto, with Amy Madigan and Ed Harris. It was Mark Lynn Baker. It was great.
Oh, my God. So what, now you've got kids now, right?
Yeah, but we don't talk about them.
Oh.
We leave them out of it.
But you're having a good time.
Yeah.
Oh, good. And you're happy in your life and everything's cool.
Everything's really good.
Well, I appreciate you talking to me for a while.
Yeah, that was really, really a blast.
That was intense and exciting. It was great to meet her. She's an awesome kind of personality. Full on Holly Hunter, exactly as you imagine Holly Hunter to be. I am on the road. I am tired. I don't know if you can hear that in my voice, but no guitar today. No guitar today. Boomer lives.